This is an ABC podcast.
But first today to the decision by Australia's highest court to grant child sex offender Cardinal George Pell a hearing in his bid to overturn his conviction. This morning, the High Court in Canberra accepted the request by Pell's legal team that it re-examine the Cardinal's sexual assault case and his six-year jail sentence. In December last year, a jury in Melbourne found the former Archbishop of Melbourne and Sydney guilty of sexually assaulting two choir boys in the 1990s. Earlier this year, the Victorian Court of Appeal upheld the jury's verdicts. Barbara Miller has the latest.
It was a stunning fall from grace for the Australian Cardinal, who became one of the highest-ranking Vatican officials, an advisor to the Pope. Now the stage is set for what will be George Pell's final chance to overturn his child sexual abuse conviction. The full bench, seven judges of the High Court, will hear the case. His legal team submitted that there was reasonable doubt that any opportunity existed for the offending at St Patrick's Cathedral in Melbourne in the 1990s to have taken place. No oral arguments were heard by the High Court before it handed down its decision.
It was a little bit of a surprise that they upheld the application simply on the basis of written submissions. Generally, when they don't call for oral arguments, that's an indication that it won't be accepted, but clearly not always the case.
Jamie Wolvish is a lecturer in the School of Law at Monash University.
I suspect that there is a lot of public interest in the issue. It's been about 25 years since the High Court has delivered any kind of authoritative judgment on how to deal with the question of unsafe verdicts, so they might have thought that it was time to clarify the law. It's also an unusual case involving historical sex events with really only one uncorroborated witness, and so they might want to have something to say about that type of a case.
So that's interesting. So in making this decision, you think the court will not only have looked at this one case, but at the wider context?
Yes, absolutely. One of the bases for accepting an appeal to the High Court is that there needs to be something in the interests of justice. And so if it was just a narrow, factual issue about this particular case, they would be unlikely to take it on. They're much more likely to take on a case that raises broader issues than in the one case in front of them.
Vivian Waller is a lawyer for the man who gave evidence against Pell.
I spoke to him this morning, and we'd also had a chat a couple of evenings ago. When it became clear that the High Court was going to be notifying everyone as to the outcome of the application for leave.
And what was his state of mind?
Look, he's very respectful of the legal process, and he'll be waiting for the outcome of the appeal like everybody else.
Some advocates for survivors of clergy abuse have suggested that this is a devastating outcome for someone in that position.
I can understand that there are many survivors who might feel disappointed by the outcome, and I can also understand that there's a lot of people who feel very deeply for my client and, are concerned for his well-being. And look, those sentiments are greatly appreciated. But he is very respectful of the process, and I think that the appeals process is an important part of the criminal justice system, and, the appeals process is an important check and balance.
Catholic commentator Paul Collins says he hopes the court's decision will be a turning point for the church.
Because the Pell case, if you like, focuses the whole sexual abuse crisis, I think that there is a sense in which the church can move on if that is finally resolved. For sure, the whole problem of sexual abuse and the church's abject failure in many ways to resolve the issue and to respond to it in any way that gave justice and care to the victims, yes, that will certainly remain. So that'll certainly remain a problem for us. But at least this, in a way, this case that somehow symbolizes that whole problem, at least that will be resolved.
It's expected the case will be heard sometime next year.
Barbara Miller reporting. Well, let's get now to the latest on the bushfire emergency. And cooler temperatures are calming conditions in New South Wales today, but the fire threat is set to worsen in Queensland, with high winds forecast and temperatures approaching 40 degrees. More than 60 fires are burning across the state. The fire causing most concern at the moment is in Spicer's Gap, about 100 kilometres west of Brisbane. Reporter George Roberts is at nearby Boona.
This is the staging ground for the Scenic Rim and some of the other fires are burning around this broader area. So the one that was causing the most trouble this morning and still is at Spicer's Gap and threatening the Spicer's Peak Lodge. There are also some other fires as well burning around this area. So there's a tent city here where they've got these quite amazing structures that they're able to fly in, set up and tackle emergencies and have crews stay here and be self-contained. Dozens of fire trucks as well. Here, obviously, the Queensland Fire and Emergency Service and Rural Fire Service are here ready to go and supporting, obviously, many more out in the field. So this is really the logistical hub for fighting the fires in this area. And of course, their biggest concern is the fire that's yet to start and the conditions that are expected to worsen later today.
What are emergency services saying about the dangers in other areas of the state?
Well, of course, they're prepared to leave and leave now orders for some of these fires around the state. There are, at last count, about 62 fires burning. Another fire sparked up at Noosa North Shore late this morning. So authorities there are saying that people there should prepare to leave if they don't have a bushfire survival plan. Of course, up in Yeppoon as well, there are evacuations going on up there for the fire that's been burning there for days now. And that's the one that's wiped out about 13 homes at last count. So people are evacuating areas up there. Of course, broadly across the state, you know, we're experiencing dry, hot conditions. Gusting winds expected to come through, especially in the south and southeast this afternoon, and that's expected to be when conditions are very problematic for firefighters.
And what are the fire authorities saying about how confident they are that they can manage this situation?
Look, I think it's fair to say that they're nervous. They're worried about the potential for fires to spark anywhere. It's quite amazing to see how they are positioning resources and tackling things, especially as this is unusual for Queensland to have been fighting fires at this time of year for a couple of months already. So resources have been stretched. They've called in extra resources overnight from the Northern Territory and from New Zealand even to come in and help out. But there has been some complaints from the state government that there just aren't enough water bombing aircraft to support the fires that they're trying to battle here and, of course, over the border in New South Wales as well. So resources are stretched, but they're doing the best they can. And their strategy is to jump on things as quickly as possible when they flare up.
Our reporter George Roberts there in the Queensland community of Boona. Well, in New South Wales, authorities are now assessing the damage from yesterday's bushfire crisis and appealing for information about a number of suspicious blazes. 50 homes were damaged or destroyed during the catastrophic fire conditions, and about a dozen fires remain of major concern. Gavin Coote reports.
More than 100 fires are still burning across New South Wales, and while the catastrophic conditions have passed, residents up the northern coastline are in the midst of yet another challenging day. Lynette Pike from the Country Women's Association is flat out preparing food for exhausted fire crews around Nimbin in the state's north.
Today it looks pretty busy and it's very smoky, and I know that all our boys and girls in the brigade are out in the Tunnable Valley, and it's going to be a long, hard day for them.
The fire in nearby Mount Nardi National Park is still burning out of control, and it's just one of 16 blazes at watch and act level in New South Wales. And as crews remain in the thick of active fire grounds, authorities are also counting the cost of yesterday's conditions, which were rated catastrophic for the first time. At least 21 people, including 13 firefighters, were injured, and the Rural Fire Service is still trying to work out the extent of property losses. Commissioner Shane Fitzsimmons.
We're estimating in the order, sadly, of another 50 homes that have been damaged or destroyed so far this season. That would then make it somewhere in the order of more than 300 homes.
And it's believed a number of the fires in Sydney suburbs were suspiciously lit. Emergency Services Minister David Elliott has this message for anyone responsible for deliberately lit fires.
You must have arrived from Mars in a bubble if you didn't know yesterday that the state was in severe danger. And the fact that we had people wanting to act outside the law, endanger their communities, really is quite offensive.
Diksha Arman is now hosing down her Tarramurra home in northern Sydney, which was covered with fluoro fire retardant when the bushfire raged just metres away.
I shouted at the kids, get in the car, get in the car. I grabbed my dog, we just left the house as soon as... And within 5 minutes while I was doing that, you can see the flames were so high, like it was embers in the air. And it was coming on my car.
What were you thinking as you were driving away along the road? You know, I guess in the rear vision mirror, you're seeing your house on one side of the road and the fire on the other.
Yeah, I saw that and I just went out of the Canoon Road. I stopped my car there and at one point I just saw, like, my house is burnt as well.
If anything, yesterday's emergency warning in Sydney's leafy North Shore has given even those urban residents a chance to put their fire plans to the test. Before yesterday's Tarramurra blaze, Rochelle thought she was well prepared, but the close call has left her reassessing things ahead of summer.
It's just the beginning. Don't know what to expect. Hopefully it's not going to be worse than what it is now.
Is it reassuring to know that this has ended up this way, you've been prepared,
yes,
or are there lessons that you can learn?
I think it's educated me to be maybe a bit more prepared, not to take things for granted, that it can happen to me.
That's Tarramurra resident Rochelle, ending Gavin Coote's report. This is The World Today. You can find us on the ABC Listen app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Well, one of those who's been in the thick of the fire danger over the last few days and has been very much on the minds of many of us here at the ABC is former ABC executive producer and foreign correspondent Edmund Roy. He and his wife live on a property at Marlee, just outside Wingham on the New South Wales mid-north coast. Their house was right in the fire zone, but somehow it survived. Edmund Roy spoke to me earlier. Ed, obviously there are a lot of people here that were worrying about you. Take us to the first moment you heard fires were likely to threaten your property.
So this was on Friday when everyone was told to actually evacuate. So we got out of the home, drove to the Marlee Fire Hall, which is in the middle of a paddock, so it's pretty safe. We stayed there and we watched the fire burn through our valley. Ridges that are 100 meters high, trees on top of that, which are 40 meters high, completely burned to the ground. So you're watching it jump from one to the other for miles on end. By then, we realized that our house is probably gone, because when the fire hits a house, it changes color. And so you see that flare up and you suddenly realize that could be my house, that could be my neighbor's house. We don't quite know yet.
What was it like that moment when you thought your home had gone?
You know, people talk about it's only possessions. Don't worry about it. You're alive. You're breathing. That's the more important thing. But when I thought for a moment that my home was destroyed, the home that I had built with a lot of love and collected a lot of stuff over the years, when I thought that I had lost it, it is almost like losing kin. At that point in time, you crumble. As a human being, you crumble. It is the most visceral reaction you can possibly have.
So you say you were in the path of that fire. Was that the most frightening time when you could see it on the ridges?
That is not the most frightening time. The next day we came back home, and that night at 3 a.m. on my northern ridge, the fire started coming down. It came down to 25 meters from my back door. I was standing there with my hose, a garden hose. That's all I had. My neighbor from across the road came around to help me, so we stood there watching it. Luckily, the wind was in the right direction. Flames were going up about 30, 35 meters. We watched it take, it snaked behind all of that, the perimeter, the clearing. It came around the serpent, around the backyard, came back up my front yard, took out my gateposts, and we stood there with a fire hose, and we put that out. We fought a fire on the northern side, the southern side, and on the eastern side in the space of 12 hours. I did not sleep for 3 days.
It sounds absolutely terrifying with being in the path of this massive fire with just a garden hose.
This is the dichotomy. This is the dilemma. Do you go and save yourself, and because that's the best option, as we all know, or do you stay and have a chance at saving your property? And the dilemma and the decision you make is very confusing, very hard, and with all the adrenaline, all of that going on, oftentimes people don't make the right decision.
Give us a sense of what it sounds like when you're surrounded by fires in the way that you were.
I have not heard anything like this. This is a different sound. This is a primeval sound. This is a sound of nature at its fury. It's, you can hear rumblings. It's like if you are living next to a freeway and there's constant traffic, multiply that about 20 times, something howling through, and you can't quite place where it's coming from. This horrible, horrendous noise, almost as if there is something coming towards you that you have absolutely no control over. And that, I think, is the scariest.
Ed, you've been a foreign correspondent. You've been in war zones. How does this experience compare?
Let me put it this way, Eleanor. I was scared to my bones. I have never been so scared in my life. The war zones are one thing. You are a reporter. You are somehow removed from the action. Here, you are part of it. You are in it. This is your community. And that is a completely different feeling. You are scared to your wit's end. You do not know how to react. You are not in control. You are it. You are at the center of it. You are the story. And that is an uncomfortable place to be.
That's former ABC journalist Edmund Roy speaking about his ordeal from his home on the mid-north coast of New South Wales. And Ed says he will be forever grateful to the New South Wales Rural Fire Service and their courageous volunteers. You can hear more from him on our website. Well, Ed and his wife decided to stay in their home last night, but hundreds of other people along the New South Wales mid-north coast slept in emergency accommodation last night. One of the biggest evacuation centres is in Taree, where more than 300 people were camped out. Our reporter Julia Holman has been speaking to Major Bruce Harmer, who's running the Salvation Army operation there.
Some folk have come to the evacuation centre having gone home already, and they've lost everything. And so they're quite stunned, and they're, you know, kind of planning next steps, talking to their insurers and that kind of thing. Other folk have gone home and their house is fine, but they don't feel comfortable there or safe at the moment with the fire still around. So they've come back as well, and their story is very different. So there's a very there's a mixture of emotions in there, a mixture of people and their experiences. But what we have in common is that we're all part of this community here in Taree, and we're going to stick together until we get through this.
One thing that I've picking up just speaking to people is there's so much uncertainty. You know, people don't know if their place is okay, and even if they do know, they're worried that you know, in the next few days or weeks that their place might be threatened. How are people dealing with that long-term stress that's compounding?
I don't think they're dealing with it that well, to be perfectly honest. I think if you sit down with people, they're quite confused and a bit bewildered by the whole situation. I was talking to a guy yesterday who has lost his house, and they were hoping that their cat might have survived, but it didn't. And so they've got that personal loss as well. And then while I was talking to him, this guy was from Rainbow Flats, while I was talking to him, he got word that his neighbour across the road, his house was going up as we were speaking. And he had lost his house some days before. So, yeah, it's just a very fluid environment at the moment and lots of different emotions.
Tell me about the support from the broader community here around Taree. What kind of support are you getting from people who aren't necessarily connected with Salvos or the other support agencies but are just live here?
Tremendous support. A lot of the food that we're serving at the moment has been donated by local businesses. Woolies, who are our Salvation Army's national disaster partner, they've been terrific, dropping off things. Our other wholesale providers as well have been terrific. Everyone's just pulling together. Can I just say that donations in kind are actually not that helpful. Food is okay, we're handling that. But other things, we will end up with far too much. And we have no real process of moving those things on after this initial phase of the disaster.
So you're talking sort of clothing, blankets, mattresses. You're saying we don't need that.
We don't really need that. The usefulness of that stuff will pass very quickly, and there will be so much stuff that we simply can't use anymore, and we have no capacity to move it, and so it's going to become a real problem. But financial contributions. If someone needs things, we can help them financially to get those things in the recovery phase, which is the Salvation Army and other agencies are already looking at that. Clearly, we're going to have an unprecedented recovery phase and we're all gearing up for that.
Yeah, tell me about what the plans are. I mean, we're still in the active emergency, but so you're already thinking ahead of what's going to have to happen to try to rebuild this community?
Absolutely. We've been thinking ahead. Well, basically, like as soon as a disaster is declared, we're on to that. The salvos usually hang around for months and years ahead to make sure that these communities are back on their feet. And unfortunately, news cycles as they are, we'll move on and we'll be talking about the tennis or something in a little while, and what's happening here locally will become not that big a news. So we're trying to prepare now and ask folk for support now so that we've got the resources to stay here and just quietly continue to work with this community.
And that's Major Bruce Harmer from the Salvation Army speaking to our reporter Julia Holman at the Taree Evacuation Centre. Well, two other news now, and the indications that an Australian man who's been held prisoner by the Taliban for 3 years may soon be released. Timothy Weeks and US national Kevin King, both professors, were abducted outside a university in Kabul. The Afghan president has now announced that he's prepared to release three senior Taliban commanders in a prisoner swap. David Sparks reports.
Timothy Weeks and his American colleague Kevin King were professors at the American University of Afghanistan in Kabul when they were kidnapped in 2016. A few months later, the Taliban released this video featuring a clearly distressed Mr. Weeks.
We ask that the American government and the American University of Kabul please speak to the American government to ask for our exchange so that we may return home.
6 months after that, another video was released in which Timothy Weeks pleaded to then Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull for help.
Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, I'm asking you now to please speak to the Taliban, to negotiate with the Taliban.
Apart from that, information about his circumstances has been hard to find. But now the Afghan President Ashraf Ghani has announced his government has released three prominent Taliban leaders to secure the release of Mr. Weeks and Mr. King. In a televised speech, President Ghani explained it was a difficult but necessary decision.
The release of these two foreign teachers was part of our main demands during the indirect negotiations with the Taliban, so we can assure their families and their countries that we welcome and honour those who come here to pursue education, and we're appreciative of their service.
The two Westerners are not free yet, and the president did not elaborate on when or where they will be released. Jacinta Carroll from the National Security College at Australian National University says extremist organisations like the Taliban weigh up whether they would get better value out of keeping a prisoner alive for bargaining purposes or simply killing them.
We've seen, of course, these horrific, very distressing pictures, particularly focused on activities in Iraq and Syria by ISIS, where it seemed that there was a balance between getting some propaganda value out of showing atrocities of executing people on video versus the difficulties that these groups would have in trying to keep someone alive.
Jacinta Carroll says the Afghan president's announcement is a positive sign, and that's not only because it provides hope that Mr. Weeks and Mr. King could soon be free. It also shows that wider efforts to negotiate a peace deal between the Taliban and the Afghan government are progressing well.
More broadly, that's a good indicator of talks happening between the authorities and between this group in Afghanistan. If you can do it with a small issue, then you might be able to use those contacts to have further negotiations to bring in a better solution, a more peaceful solution for Afghanistan.
The Department of Foreign Affairs has welcomed President Ghani's announcement and says the Afghan government is leading negotiations for Mr. Weeks' release.
David Sparks reporting, and that's all from the World Today team for this Wednesday. Linda Mottram and the PM team will be along this evening, and we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Eleanor Hall. Have a lovely afternoon.
Hi, I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre.
And I'm Chris Dengate, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. This week, an unprecedented number of people are being asked to make the decision, stay or go.
Today's episode is about the people who decide not to leave their homes, even in the face of a severe bushfire risk. Why do they make that call, and is there a way to change their minds?
Find The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.